The state's power to engage in national security policymaking is a master key because it opens all doors, including the doors that might otherwise obstruct the government's invasion of our most cherished rights to life, liberty, and property. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone and the Libertarian Institute. That is a quote from this excellent new book, In Search of Monsters to Destroy, The Folly of American Empire and Paths to Peace by Dr. Chris Coyne. Check out the link in the description below. I absolutely loved this book. Dr. Coyne, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Keith. It's great to talk with you again.
What is the economic way of thinking as you describe it in the introduction to this book?
Sure. The economic way of thinking is a very straightforward analytical framework. And really, it's just based on a few assumptions, which are not very controversial if you think about it. The first is that people act purposefully. That is, they're goal-oriented. So they seek to the best of their ability, given the constraints they face. That can be knowledge constraints, resource constraints, or others. They try the best they can to achieve their desired ends. So purposive behavior. And then people respond to incentives. People respond to changes in costs and benefits as they perceive them. And that's really the core of the economic way of thinking. And how that relates to this then is to think about how those core insights from economics apply to the operation of empire. And the way many people conceptualize the state in matters in general, but certainly when it comes to matters of national defense, security, and so on, is that the state is going to look out for you and I. It is going to protect us from enemies. So it's kind of this conception where you have this almost supercomputer. I call it the defense brain, this kind of supercomputer that just simply extracts optimal resources from the private sector and spits out optimal outcomes in terms of protection in the name of the national interest. And what I'm trying to do is unpack this defense brain and open it up and say, well, wait a second, let's actually think about what this thing is, how it operates, and the people embedded within it, how do they operate? And to do that, I argue economics is quite powerful for parsing through all the nuances.
On page 61, you mention rent seeking and rent extraction. What are those? How do they relate to the foreign policy thesis you're putting forward?
Sure. So rent seeking is the expenditure of resources to seek political favors. That relates because once you make an enormous pool of resources available, which is what the national security state does, there's an enormous amount of money flying around, whether it is through the Department of Defense base budget, whether it's through contingency budgeting for its various special operations, research and development, atomic research and the operation of the atomic or nuclear program. It's enormous amount of money. Well over $1 trillion. And people want that money. Those are profit opportunities for people that are able to maneuver through the political process to secure it. And so what do we expect to happen? We expect the people who want to secure those resources to expend a significant amount of effort and resources to get them. And that's where rent seeking comes in. Rent extraction is when political gatekeepers have discretion over resources. Because, of course, in order to get money from political people, you need to interact with those political people, which gives them power over you. They can then use that role as gatekeeper to extract resources from you. They can say, look, private contracting firm, unless you donate to my campaign or to my cause or to this nonprofit, you have less of a likelihood of getting the contracts. And so while rent seeking is the desire to obtain privilege by expending resources, rent extraction are payments to political gatekeepers to avoid political disfavor, to avoid political gatekeepers imposing harms upon you. And both of these things are at operation throughout politics, but certainly in the national security sector.
So this could more or less be the explanation for why you could have someone say, how is it that no one says, I want to go to war, but there's governments always going to war with each other? You're generally claiming that because of the concentrated benefits through the rent-seeking process, they're able to, they have a big incentive to go in and make such a thing happen, whereas the average person might not like it. But if they could spend 1,000 hours and not convince anyone and have but very little or nothing to show for it. Anything else on concentrated benefits and dispersed costs?
Yeah, just that you're exactly right, that these issues permeate all aspects of the national security apparatus. I mean, the big issue is simply one of a lack of accountability in terms of a tight connection between decision makers and the people that incur those costs. And so the rent seeking, rent extraction is part of it, but even more broadly, simply adopting bad policy and sustaining bad policy. So even if you adopt a policy and it's clearly failing, there's an inherent bias towards having that policy persist because pulling back makes you look bad. So withdrawing from an intervention, oh, that's the politician that pulled out their weak. But the cost of doing it falls on lots of other people, both domestically and internationally. And that, I think, goes a long way in explaining both why we observe highly dysfunctional foreign policy, but also why the idea that somehow political actors are looking out for the interests of the little person, that they're somehow protecting our person and property, is more often than not simply not the case.
You open the book talking about Libya in 2011. I want to give you Barack Obama's side of things. You tell me what, if anything, is wrong about this. Obama says in A Promised Land, "We met for another 2 hours that night in the Situation Room, going point by point through the plan I'd sketched out in my mind during the dinner, knowing we had to try to prevent a massacre in Libya while minimizing the risks and burdens on an already overstretched U.S. military. I was ready to take a meaningful stance against Gaddafi and to give the Libyan people an opportunity to engineer a new government. But we would do it swiftly with the support of allies and with the parameters of our mission clearly spelled out." Still, March ended without a single U.S. casualty in Libya and for an approximate cost of $550 million, not much more than what we spent per day on military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. We had accomplished our objective of saving Benghazi and its neighboring cities and perhaps tens of thousands of lives. It was the quickest international military intervention to prevent a mass atrocity in modern history. What would happen with regard to Libya's government remained unclear, with Gaddafi ordering further attacks, even in the face of NATO bombing operations, and with the opposition fueled by a loose coalition of rebel militias. Doesn't sound too bad. No U.S. casualties. They take out a mass murdering dictator. What is the other side of that?
Yeah, well, that certainly all sounds nice, both in terms of the intentions and the supposed outcomes. In other words, if that is taken at its word, or President Obama's taken at his word in that book, and I'll come back to his future words that he said later on, which I have in the book in a moment, in my book, that sounds nice. It's all benefit, no cost, actually, or to the extent there is a cost, it's the equivalent of pennies, since, as he points out, we were spending that daily in other foreign interventions. The problem is it didn't work that way at all. And later on, this is why I said I'd come back to President Obama, he said this was one of his greatest, if not his greatest regret of his presidency, the Libyan intervention. Because he said, we did everything right. He basically said what you just quoted. He said, we had the resources. We didn't have any American boots on the ground, except it led to a disaster. It led to a devastating civil war that imposed massive harm, personal harm, regional harm, on the most vulnerable people in that area. Why? Because you overthrow a government and it's not like manna falls from on high. It's not like all of a sudden you get a liberal set of political and social and economic institutions that simply fall down. It led to a power vacuum and then led to chaos. And that chaos still persists. And so this is, I use this example because it is a perfect example of the hubris of foreign policy elite for exactly the quote you just read, which is, we can do this and it's wonderful and it's all going to be, you know, perfect and it's not going to cost a lot. That's the promise of every foreign intervention. Yet when they don't turn out that way, people are like, well, oops, sorry, it didn't go well. We'll try harder next time. And then we just get next time. And to my way of thinking, what this highlights is even when you have supposedly the best set of circumstances, it more often than not ends up being a disaster. And so what do we take from that? Not let's try harder next time, but perhaps our bar for intervening should be so extraordinarily high because, as President Obama put it in the passage you read, we don't know what would have happened. It could have been really bad, maybe. But if we look at the empirical record of interventions, we know that they do significant harm, concrete harm to ordinary people. And those costs are real. And so we know there's going to be real costs in terms of harm to people. There might be potential benefits, but we don't know if there will be. And when you take into account the economics of it and the political economy of it, there's reason to think there's going to be massive dysfunction. That gives me great pause in advocating for foreign interventions, even if they are undertaken in the name of humanitarianism and helping others. And that's really the challenge. The challenge is this. Every time a potential foreign intervention comes up, the do-gooders can point to grand humanitarian motivations. They can say, the innocent people are going to suffer. If we don't intervene, the most ruthless authoritarian despots are going to do great harm. And so therefore, we need to intervene. And it's hard to push back on that in the moment, precisely because they are biasing the discussion towards these grand humanitarian ends, which we all share. No one wants other human beings to suffer, all else constant. But from people coming from my perspective, we advocate for great care and humility precisely because we realize that efforts to do good may not just fail, but may impose even greater harms among the very people you purport to want to protect. And when that's the case, refraining from intervening is a greater good to our fellow human beings as compared to intervening.
Yeah, I'm even familiar with explicit lies, not just misleading statements. Are you familiar with the early 90s, a woman claiming to be a nurse in Kuwait said in front of the United Nations that Iraqi soldiers came into a hospital, took babies out of incubators and left them to die on the cold floor?
Certainly.
And then George H.W. Bush mentions this in a speech and gets everyone all worked up. Are you familiar with explicit fairy tales being pushed to justify these interventions?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. So my longtime co-author and former student, Abby Hall, and I wrote a whole book called Manufacturing Militarism, which you and I have talked about in a different discussion, that the war on terror as a whole was permeated by at best manipulated information, if not by outright lies. The claims with Libya, there is nothing like the case of Iraq that we know that you pointed to, which is a classic case of this. You know, it's really hard to get information from people on the ground in real time. And of course, if you want to intervene anywhere in the world, anywhere, even in developed countries, you can find bad stuff happening because we're human beings and bad stuff happens. And so I can cherry pick out, I could go anywhere in the United States right now and point to something bad happening and saying, see, you need to intervene to fix that over there. And if you hold a position where then you can wield the levers of military power, you can justify that. And so again, to my way of thinking, this dynamic, the incentive to skew and bias information that you collect and present in a very selective way to justify your intended action is reason for great skepticism on the part of the citizenry, where typically we are pushed to think the opposite, where this is a moment of crisis. This is a moment of urgency. We need to act now. And if you push back, citizen, you are anti-patriotic and you don't care about your fellow human being and people suffering around the world, when it's just the opposite.
I like what you said about how, yes, there are terrible things going on in these places, but it applies everywhere. It would be like saying, oh, you know, with America, that there's the inflation, there's an increase in the murder rate, there's this rioting and these looting and these police brutality. I think Putin needs to intervene and stabilize the region. And once the region stabilized, well, then Putin can withdraw. It's like, well, that certainly seems like a power move and just a blank check for him to control tons of other people. But unfortunately, people just have this one double standard, which this book does a phenomenal job in refuting. I love how you use two New York Times articles, one in 2011, U.S. tactics in Libya may be a model for other efforts. Later, you quote a future headline, ISIS grip on Libyan city gives it a fallback option. So actually, it created a power vacuum for LIFG, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which is Al-Qaeda in Libya.
Yep.
I'm This has to be one of the worst. Blunder's a cheap term for mass murder. But I mean, this is just unbelievable. The people who we sought to destroy after the towers came down, took the city we liberated.
Yep. And I think it's quite powerful. And the reason I chose that, it captures the essence well. But of course, the New York Times is historically has been very supportive of U.S. Foreign policy and interventions. And so the fact that there's even a critical headline about it, not that they made the comparison that I make, but that they recognize that city fell into the hands of the enemy is quite powerful in itself. But that's something you see and something I talk about in the book, where you tend to see this cycle, because you can never do just one thing when you intervene in a complex system, which is what the world is. It's a series of overlapping complex systems. So you intervene in the name of doing good. It has this array of perverse consequences. In addition to the direct immediate effects of harming some people, oftentimes innocent people and marginalized people. And then that necessitates subsequent intervention. So it's like, oh, now we got to go back into Libya because see that the terrorists have a stronghold on it. Well, why do they have a stronghold on it? Because you destroyed the existing equilibrium, which I admit was a terrible equilibrium compared to some first best ideal that we could imagine. But that first best ideal is not in the feasibility set. It's not something that we can actually accomplish. And so you U.S. government have caused this harm. Now you're arguing that we need to go back and stay there, intervene repeatedly to combat these terrorist groups. And it's a never-ending cycle. And it continually justifies itself because, again, now you can say, well, we need to go back in because there's bad people there. But wait, I thought we went in the first place to get rid of the bad people. So what's going on here? And when you start paying attention to this never-ending cycle, you realize that it's just a futile effort. It's an ongoing. It is literally the perpetual war for perpetual peace, and that suffers from internal inconsistency, of course, in logical terms, but in practical terms, it's just a recipe for illiberalism and significant harms to people around the world.
Now, another example of this would be after the Gulf War. There was a bombing campaign and sanctions campaign in Iraq throughout the 90s, which killed tons of innocent people. The numbers are so hard to nail down because of all the lying. And then after that, it still wasn't enough. All the bombing and all the sanctions, all the terrorism committed by the state, they still weren't happy with it. So here is how some of the most important people at the time conveyed to us the need for a new foreign interventionism.
We all remember the lies that led the U.S. into the Iraq War.
I don't think we ever said, at least I know I didn't say, that there was a direct connection between September the 11th and Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein aids and protects terrorists, including members of Al-Qaeda.
You have said in the past that it was, quote, pretty well confirmed.
No, I never said that.
Okay.
No, it's absolutely not. What I said was, it's been pretty well confirmed that he did go to Prague and he did meet with a senior official of the Iraqi intelligence service.
It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not.
We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north somewhere.
So when you see something like that, are we dealing with people who need better information, or are we dealing with bad actors, or is there another angle you want to take on that?
Yeah, well, certainly not better information. We know that. And we know now, looking back, and again, the problem is for a citizen, for a voter in a polity, it is very hard to disentangle what politicians know because they purposely conceal it. And we don't have access to much of the information they do. But we know in hindsight that there was a direct and purposeful manipulation of information, both for Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as the broader war on terror. And of course, you know, we have the Pentagon Papers. We have lots of instances throughout U.S. history where this has happened. So this is not like a new phenomena. So why does this happen? This is what economists call information asymmetries. Information asymmetries are when different parties have different information. And you and I experience this in every aspect of our life. When you are in a relationship and dating someone, there's information asymmetries. That's why you get to know someone. When you are buying a used car, there's information asymmetries. Is this person trying to get one over on you by selling a bad car or not to you? But we have mechanisms in private life to overcome this. We have certifications for used cars and so on. In politics, we don't have that when it comes to matters of national security. And so members of this highly concentrated very small, large in the aggregate sense, but very small compared to the number of people in the world in the national security state. And even within that, smaller groups have access to very confidential information, which they purposely conceal from both the voting public, but also even from members of Congress who are involved with congressional oversight. Because a lot of people say, well, congressional oversight is supposed to check the national security state. Well, where do they get the information to check them? From members of the national security state. And so if we go back to our economic framework that we talked about at the beginning, and we say, well, people respond to incentives. If you're reporting on yourself to the members of Congress that oversee you, of course, you're going to present information that makes you look good. And you are going to exclude information that might make you look bad. And for ordinary voters, there's simply no way to know what government is doing in its entirety and who's responsible. And so this allows the type of thing you just saw, which is not just do they lie, then they lie about lying. They literally said, I never said that. And so one of the amazing things that's happened in U.S. politics is, you know, during the Donald Trump kind of era, not that it's ended necessarily, but during his presidency, people would say, like, I can't believe a president says things like he says. I can't believe that someone lies like he does. And it's like, I don't know what politicians you've been following for prior to Donald Trump, but this is not a new phenomenon. It is embedded in politics, which is systematic lying for a small group of people, irrespective of political party, by the way, for a small group of people to pursue the ends they want to pursue. And the national security state, because of its confidentiality and the secrecy and the ability to classify information as being crucial for national security, which is a privilege that has been exploited to the hilt by members of the national security state, because you can just conceal anything you want or almost anything you want. It's ripe for this type of abuse and opportunism. And so it's not a matter of better people, or it's not a matter of better information, just the opposite. It's the fact that those people have privileged information that you and I can't get access to.
Niall Ferguson wrote a book called Kissinger, the Idealist, and he tries to summarize a brief bumper sticker for what Kissinger's foreign policy is. On page 23, he says, as Kissinger pointed out to Arianna Felici, the history of things that didn't happen needs to be considered before we may pass any judgment on the history of things that did happen. We need to consider not only the consequences of what American governments did during the Cold War, but also the probable consequences of the different foreign policies that might have been adopted. So when looking at foreign policies that have allegedly failed, we are still in a world where Hitler's, Mao's, and Stalin's can still rise up. So when it comes to that mindset, how do you respond?
Well, I respond by saying that certainly there are bad people in the world. So number one, I don't want to deny that. Of course there are. That's a fact of human nature and a social constant. There, we live in a world where conflict is ubiquitous. Conflict, I don't mean violence, by the way. I mean a situation where there is a conflict of interest, and that leads to conflict. So one of the things I emphasize towards the end of the book is we need to have a kind of reconceptualization of all this. And it almost seems intimidating. We have these nation states and the UN and these international organizations, and it's so big and it's beyond me as an individual. But if you think about it, you and I and everyone else watching and listening have a lot of power. Why do I say that? In our daily lives, we navigate many conflicts from the moment we get up. If you have roommates or if you have a family, there's conflict from the moment you get up. Multiple people want to use the coffee maker at the same time. If you have kids, they both want to control the television. If you go to work, you have conflicts with people. Most of us navigate those conflicts peacefully. We don't resort to violence to do so. Sometimes things spill over to violence, but in many cases, they don't. We take those for granted. Why is that important? Because the minute you realize that, number one, conflict is everywhere, and we as individuals navigate it constantly, we realize that conflict does not have to lead to violence. It's a choice. It is an object of choice. Now, sometimes people choose to do things to us. But again, in a multitude of interactions between people, that's not the case. And you say, well, that's just within America. Well, America is a really diverse place, and we interact with lots of people. And even within this thing we call not the nation state, but the states within the nation state. If you travel, I live in Virginia, I'm in Northern Virginia right now. If you travel down to Southern Virginia, culturally, it is a dramatically different place than Northern Virginia. nonetheless, I can drive down to Southern Virginia and interact with people. And again, it's not that violence never breaks out, but it's relatively rare, which is why it gets attention when it does. So how do we extrapolate from that to the rest of the world? Well, let's think in that logic across borders, just like we do within the United States. We think about navigating conflicts, whether it's in Virginia and West Virginia. We don't worry about violence breaking out. Is that because we have police and the military? I don't think so. I don't think the reason that most people don't engage in violence because the state, we have the shadow of the state. In other words, I don't walk around and at least explicitly, even though implicitly when I think about it, I don't walk around and say, I'm not going to punch people today because I don't want to get I don't want police called. It's because I have certain expectations and norms about how to interact with other human beings. And when you interact with other human beings, when the norms are this thing we call China or Russia or Mexico or India or whatever is against us, first of all, it's collectivism writ large. It is America and China, no individuals. It's the aggregate. And they are set up as being enemies. Then you're going to elevate violence as a means of interacting with your enemies because they're framed as being a threat rather than navigating things peacefully. Now, that doesn't address then the kind of situation you raise where they say, well, what about these horrible people that might rise up? And I say, horrible people might rise up. We can't prevent that from happening, but we also can't prevent that from happening through foreign intervention. In fact, we encourage it, which seems counterintuitive to people. Aren't we preventing the bad people from rising up? Not if you look at the historical record. If you look at the historical record, numerous interventions around the world have led to the rise of authoritarian governments. Why? In some cases, you get like the Libya type outcome. You get an overthrow of government. It's a power vacuum. And who's going to rise up in a power vacuum? The nice, kind, gentle people or the people that are specialists in violence? Typically the latter. Or in many cases, the U.S. government has implemented puppet governments who are typically brutal authoritarian governments because they are able to control people. And the U.S. government, like all governments, likes that. What governments do is control people. That is the inherent tendency of governments, whether domestically or internationally. So you can see case after case of the U.S. government involved intervening. You don't have to go that far. Just look at the history of U.S. interventions in Latin America. And you see many cases of them either supporting or directly helping establish these brutal regimes who become client states of the U.S. government and extensions of the U.S. government and are among the most brutal leaders you could wish for. The final thing I just want to mention is that in recognizing that there are bad people in the world, we have to have a symmetry of assumptions. What I mean by that is it's not just that there's bad people in China or Russia or wherever, and America is somehow immune to having bad people. Bad people exist in all walks of life and live in all geographic places. Why does this matter? Because empire requires someone to run it. And that then turns to issues of selection mechanisms. So how do you select who gets picked to run that empire? That then leads to some fascinating issues like what type of people are going to tend to enjoy wielding power over other human beings. And in the book, I leverage the insights of two famous economists, Frank Knight and F.A. Hayek. And Frank Knight, they were both talking about planning, economic planning. And they did a thought experiment. What kind of people are going to tend to rise to positions of power in the economic planning apparatus? And Frank Knight pointed out, well, probably someone like on a slave plantation who would choose to be the whipping boy. The whipping boy is when slaves didn't do what they were supposed to do, they were lashed in order to control them. And you think, well, what type of person feels comfortable beating another human being? Probably a really terrible person, because a normal person would be repulsed by the idea of lashing another human being. F.A. Hayek in The Road to Serfdom has a chapter called Why the Worst Get on Top. Under economic planning, because he says, look, what type of people like telling other people what to do, where they can work, what they can consume, and then backing that up by force when people don't voluntarily comply? Probably terrible people. And so once you start thinking about what is entailed with running empire, which is forcing other people to do things, existing outside of constitutional constraints so that you can do things like black sites, you can have torture, you can have drone attacks on innocent people, and then just say, ah, it's just collateral damage. You know, war is hell. What do you expect to happen? It's going to be people that feel comfortable saying that. And the people that feel comfortable saying that are not going to be the nice, benevolent humanitarians. And that's what we need to be wary of. And so certainly there is the possibility of terrible people rising to power in other contexts outside of America. But there's also that possibility within America. And one thing that empire guarantees is that you're going to select people that feel comfortable wielding significant power over others and give them a lot of power. And that is reason, to my way of thinking, for grave concern and humility and for restraining that power before you ever let it out of the bag in the first place.
Have you taken this thesis and applied it to other countries? I'm thinking of Germany going into the First World War, made Germany a much weaker country. Russia going into the First World War. It would be hard if they had a big domestic military there if the Bolshevik Revolution could have happened. In Japan going into China in the early 30s led to, you know, them eventually losing tons of people and getting nuked. So, I mean, isn't this just not a U.S. issue? It's almost like a universal human economic moral law that everyone needs to appreciate.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a law because I'm sure people can find exceptions at a point in time, but certainly I think you're right. And if you just look at the history of empires in general, there's a rise and decline of empires. And there's a tendency for empires to, in many ways, historically, to engage in self-defeating behaviors because of imperial overreach, because they undertake wars and excursions and interventions, even if they win at the moment, however that's defined. It can have such devastating consequences in terms of the erosions of everything from the public purse. So by that, I mean public finances, to the moral fabric of the society itself, whether it is among the polity or among political institutions, that the whole thing starts to unravel. And the problem is, in many cases, people don't know it's happening until it's too late. And so maintaining a free society really does place a significant burden on members of the populace, the general citizenry, to take an active role, but also to recognize the industrial organization and the dynamics and the operation of the political machinery, and to care about that. And one reason, because some people say, well, why do you write books like this? You know, it's a pipe dream that you think you can kind of restrain the American national security state and you can change foreign policy. And it's like, certainly, I don't purport or pretend to think that I myself can change or even influence these things. But what I can influence, hopefully, is the way that ordinary people who are interested in these matters understand and think about them. And ultimately, all state power is dependent on enough people buying into it. And when I say enough people, I mean ordinary people. That's why I was saying before that individuals have a lot more power and agency than they realize, because we are indoctrinated from a young age into thinking, no, we must have governments do X, Y, and Z and provide security, or else we'll live in the Hobbesian jungle where life is as nasty, brutish, and short. Perhaps, but perhaps not. And there's reason to believe that that doesn't have to be the case, but that requires us and our fellow private citizens to understand that and think through the implications of it.
Can you walk us through some of Adam Smith's insights when it comes to how domestic populations can not benefit from their countries being imperialistic?
Yes. So in the, I'm glad you raised this. So in The Wealth of Nations, so 1776, Smith talks about the colonies, and he talks about how the colonies are a drag on the homeland. All right. Now, why are they a drag on the homeland? He says they're for several reasons. Number one, they're expensive to maintain. They're just expensive. You have to have military forces over there. You need to maintain not just those forces, but those forces need the power then to keep the colonists in line. But interestingly, and this goes back to where we started with rent seeking and rent extraction, Smith has a wonderful set of arguments about special interest groups. The special interest groups for him are the shopkeepers, the merchants. And what he says is, look, when you have colonies, you know, you think that these colonies, you know, the way that the political leaders talk about them, very much like the clips you played, are they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart, and they want to make the world a safer place and benefit people that are suffering abroad. And he says, really what's happening is the shopkeepers are lining their pockets because they want access to the market, both the resources abroad and the markets abroad, and they want monopoly control over them. And the best way to do that is to have your government go in and establish a colony. Then they can set things up so that the shopkeepers at home are able to send their goods over. They're able to block out competitors from other countries. And this is a great setup for the shopkeepers. But Smith is fully cognizant of the idea that the general populace does not benefit from it. It is a concentrated set of benefits that fall on the vested interests. And that's quite powerful. And so for him, you have the public finance aspect. That is that these things are really expensive and put a severe set of pressures on public finances, but also that it's not like you get significant benefits that are broad in their nature. You get very targeted benefits that line the pockets of vested interest groups. And to my way of thinking, that's a quite a really powerful set of tools to understand this. Again, there's the threat's even greater, I think, or the costs are greater because of the harms that you do to people in the process of this. But he points out a set of great political economy arguments that I think still resonate today.
And when it comes to what's sometimes called man's search for meaning, it's almost like this void that just has to be filled. Like it's the actual power vacuum for each person. So if it's, you know, not Dick Cheney telling us the way to exert America and for us to be beneficial in the world is for us to go into Iran, North Korea, China, or Russia. So is there a way that we could still sell people on, look, you love America? So do I. In fact, I love it more because I don't want to weaken it by sending it into wars based on lies. But okay, we both love America. How can American ideals, Declaration of Independence, freedom of speech, gun rights, voluntary exchanges, objective universal truths, and unalienable rights, how can we spread those ideas and change people's minds in the absence of foreign military interventions, sanctions, or wars?
Yeah, I don't mean to sound flippant in my response, but by doing exactly the opposite of those things, that's the way you spread. So the two ways there's more than two ways, I guess, but it's like, can you spread liberal values through force? Well, there's something odd about that in itself. The idea of employing illiberal means in the name of liberalism. I'm going to kick in people's door in the name of freedom. Something is very rotten at the core there from the get-go. Before you even do anything, just the idea of thinking in those terms. So the way I think about it is that if we take an approach where we actually live by our liberal values. So what does that mean? A respect for human dignity and freedom at the individual level, not because someone happens to be born in a different geographic space or they ever any less human than anyone else. And they are also not their government. So you can say Putin is a terrible person. Okay, that doesn't mean that every Russian, therefore, deserves the fate of Putin. And imposing costs upon ordinary people have significant costs, and those costs are immediate, long-term, but this also raises a host of ethical issues about how you treat people. And then when you move into matters of war, it raises ethical questions, not just in terms of, you know, is how you treat people, but in terms of legal questions, in terms of international law. We have, for better or for worse, and for all their imperfections, we have norms and laws of war about how you treat people. But those things just are pushed by the wayside. I mean, think about sanctions. You raised this earlier in the case of Iraq, but we can go think about anywhere. We impose sanctions in order to hurt the leaders of the country. But what we end up doing is, again, it kind of falls under the broad umbrella of collateral damage, but it's human beings you're hurting. And so think about the ethical implications of that. I'm going to hurt leader X by harming millions of innocent people. Something, again, is rotten at the core of that way of thinking about the world, to my way of thinking. So then what does that mean? Well, the best we can do, which is quite good to my way of thinking, is pursue consistently liberal values. So we offer human beings who reside in one place, we'll stick to America just for the purpose of our discussion, the opportunity to interact with other people. Whether they do it or not, that's up to them. Whether other people do it or not, that's up to them. But liberalism, if you're consistent in the adoption of those values, means you cannot force people to interact with you. You cannot force people to live a certain way. That might mean that illiberalism exists in the world. I can't deny that. That's just a part of the world the way it is. But then saying, well, there's illiberalism, so I'm going to be illiberal, to my way of thinking, is a recipe for disaster. You are giving up the very values you purport to want to protect and expand in the name of protecting those values. But the game's over from the start. And so there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, by the way, for those that actually wanted to pursue these values. The United States government does an enormous amount of harm to people. It's the world's largest arms dealer. Much of those weapons go to the worst governments in the world. Think about the Saudi regime. It blocks people from trading with other human beings, whether it is through goods and services or the free movement of labor, voluntary movement of labor, meaning people themselves. Those are all ways to harm people. Sanctions, as we talked about earlier, tons of sanctions at all different levels and all around the world. These are just recipes for harming people. Setting the precedent for the use of robotics in warfare. The U.S. government has been the world's leader in the use of drones. Now the precedent is set. It's okay to use drones, and not even on battlefields, but outside of formally declared war zones. So again, it's like we're not even pretending that there's any kind of international law that we're trying to minimize the devastating effects of these technologies. Because America is doing it, somehow that is noble and good. But now the table has been set for governments all around the world to use these technologies. And so, you know, that's why I think that liberalism requires acting liberal, which I realize in some senses is like a tautological, but I think it bears repeating, and it should be our operating principle. Are we acting in a liberal way? And if not, what are the implications of that?
Carrie Lake is a former news anchor, very well known in Arizona, ran for governor recently. But one of her major things was questioning the election legitimacy. But the second thing that she would always run on, and Tulsi Gabbard endorsed her for this, was she was really going to get tough on the war on drugs. She said that even we might have to have the military come down to the border and start bombing the tunnels and declare war on the Mexican drug cartel and all these illegals coming in here unjustly. On page 83, you discuss lessons from the U.S. war on drugs in Afghanistan. What can we learn from the U.S. war on drugs in Afghanistan?
Well, depending how familiar people are, they can either learn a lot about the war on drugs more generally, or they can take what they know about the war on drugs and that America has been leading, the American government has been leading for decades, and try to understand what happened in Afghanistan. But I dedicated a chapter to that topic because I'll come to that in a moment, because I think it's so powerful, because the U.S. government spent about $9 billion that we know of and an enormous amount of efforts to destroy poppy farms, which Afghanistan's the main source of poppy in the world. And that figure you just held up is the amount of land under cultivation. And that the line in the middle is the U.S. occupation. And so in some sense, that's all you really need to know. The U.S. invades and the amount of land under cultivation increased, and not didn't just increase a little bit, but dramatically. With $9 billion of expenditure, the DEA and other federal agencies sending over expertise. And it was just the war on drugs, the same logic within Afghanistan. It led to the Taliban becoming empowered. You had cartels forming with the Taliban at the head. You had ordinary people who turned against America and all that it stood for. Again, those liberal values. Why? Because many ordinary Afghan citizens make their livelihood being poppy farmers. So they feed themselves and their families. They're not these criminal masterminds. But what did the U.S. government do? It goes in and criminalized poppy production, and then went around and at moments literally destroyed the crop. So imagine you have your entire livelihood, and you're relatively poor by global standards, certainly by Western standards, and you are dependent on poppy farming. And then you have a foreign occupier come in and simply destroy your crop. I mean, how would any rational, sane person react? Well, you'd not just be upset, you would hate the people that destroyed your livelihood, and you would turn to people that could protect you. And who are those people? The Taliban. So you had a concentration of power in the hands of the Taliban. You had these massive waves of ordinary citizens in Afghanistan turning against American and liberal values, and a waste of resources that led to not just no effect, but making things worse. I mean, the U.S. government would have been better off just burning the $9 billion and not doing anything. Maybe that graph wouldn't have gone up so much. And so it's a classic case of the economics of prohibition combined with just arrogance and just throwing more resources after bad and failed efforts. And again, you have this cycle where it just reinforces itself. Now, take that example and then extend it across all the different portfolio of activities that the American government did in Afghanistan. And it gives you a pretty good sense of why we observed such dysfunction and the terrible outcome that we ultimately did and continue to observe today.
With the Afghanistan war being one of the holy wars of our generation, you can question Syria, Libya, even Iraq now. I mean, people like Tucker Carlson have come around. There's very few defenders of Iraq still. Even Bill Kristol is not bragging about it, or David Frum. But Afghanistan was one of these big ones until the Taliban took over 11 days after the withdrawal, as if there was nothing to show for it. And then, like clockwork, they just moved on to Putin and President Xi. Now, it's like the war on terror has completely ended, disappeared. Yep. I haven't heard a single thing. Zawahiri, I guess, was killed. And I heard Jake Sullivan say that, allegedly. And then still, I heard nothing else. So the question is, how is it that they're able to keep people motivated and really in the spirit of supporting these interventions when there's such a difficult track record? Even the Second World War killed 400,000 Americans, something very horrible. So one of the theses that has been put forward is a document published allegedly by Senator John McCain and Senator Jeff Flake, titled Tackling Paid Patriotism, a Joint Oversight Support. $6.8 million of taxpayer-funded contracts containing salutes, color guards, anthems, and more. I'm going to read one section. Dear taxpayer, in 2013, a roaring crowd cheered as the Atlanta Falcons welcomed 80 National Guard members who unfurled an American flag across Georgia's dome turf. Little did those fans, or millions of other Americans, know that the National Guard had actually paid the Atlanta Falcons for this display of patriotism as part of a $315,000 marketing contract. So what do you think about this thesis that the reason is that the Pentagon and the U.S. Entertainment Liaison actually infiltrates all places of society to sort of change public opinion?
Yeah, so I think this plays a key role. I don't think there is a single factor that leads to empire and the imperialism associated with it. So I think it's multifaceted. But I certainly think this: in order for government to sustain in general, and certainly for any program, enough people have to be on board. You need enough support. That even goes for authoritarian regimes, by the way, not just democracies. Throughout its history, again, that's the latest iteration that report you put up, or one of the latest in kind of iterations that we know about. Throughout American history, the American government has engaged in propaganda for a variety of reasons, but certainly for war. And again, the nice part, or perhaps the sad part, depending how you look at it, nice because it makes it very clear, is that for periods of time, they were very clear about it. I mean, we have something called the Creel Committee, the Committee on Public Information, whose very purpose, we're talking about the world wars now, whose very purpose was to create public information that was provided to the, to the public citizenry. We have famous film producers during World War II who are contracted by the American government to make videos that are pro-war propaganda. And so this is all just the latest iteration of this. It's much more covert now. So it's not as explicit. In other words, the U.S. government doesn't come out and say we're creating a committee to control public information. But you have these kind of sporting event efforts. You have the entertainment industry. You have media, members of the media who are entangled with government. By the way, famous broadcasters like Walter Cronkite and others have pointed this out. This isn't like some conspiracy theory, which is during times of war, members of the media become sympathetic to government. Why? Well, there's a variety of reasons. One is, Cronkite points out, well, they're citizens of their country, so they're going to tend to, like other citizens, they grew up in that country, they were taught the importance of the military and patriotism, so they're going to tend to be patriotic, all else constant, by supporting members of the military. But what else? Let's go back to incentives. They need to get access to members of the government in order to get the breaking report. A lot of them want to be embedded with members of the military. One of the ways in media that you kind of move up the ranks quickly is you go into a conflict-ridden zone and you report from the war zone. But in some sense, it's all very sanitized. You are, it's not that there's no danger, but you're not following people around in the middle of the war itself. You're kept in certain areas away from it. And those kind of incentives lead members of the media to tend to be quite sympathetic to not just other members of the military, but the broader goals themselves. And so that's why on the kind of skepticism and pushback you typically get is by people outside the mainstream media, which, by the way, plays a crucial role as serving as a check on society. Members of the mainstream media like to downplay that and say, see, that's just the fringe media. They're the crazy conspiracy theory people. Well, throughout history, the crazy conspiracy theory people were perceived as that, oftentimes were right. Things were later on revealed, as thankfully to whistleblowers and other people that revealed information publicly. And so I think that these efforts to indoctrinate people, to convince people of the need for government to do these things, certainly plays a key role and exists from a very young age. When kids are in school, when kids watch TV, when kids walk through airports, and of course, when kids go to sporting events, which is what the paid patriotism stuff is. And so again, what does that require? Well, it requires a citizenry that is aware of that, that is aware of the tendency of members of government to propagandize them. And again, to recognize the power they have, which is we as individuals have the power to be skeptical of the information that is being communicated to us. That doesn't mean you have to be cynical of everything. It doesn't mean you have to be pessimistic about the world. But here's the thing. Going back to the passage you read from President Obama, when a politician, irregardless of political party, irregardless of country, when they say grandiose things that make it sound like they can deliver the Garden of Eden to you at zero cost, be skeptical. That's a good starting point. Because something's amiss, something is off. It doesn't pass the smell test, and that skepticism is a good starting point. It's not the finishing point; it's the starting point. The tendency is for people to say, "Well, my person is in charge, or my political party is in charge, so this time it's going to be different." Or it's a time of crisis; we all have to rally behind the executive or whomever it is. And that, when you do that, it kind of gives up the game because you don't have that healthy and patriotic skepticism, which is required for a free society.
It's what I've referred to as the Santa Claus mindset. It's like, how could someone believe that at no cost, a guy is getting presents for everyone on the planet, and in 24 hours, he's able to travel this distance? It's like, what kind of idiot would believe that? Oh, someone who doesn't believe in opportunity costs or any, semblance of reality. So yeah, a child would believe it. The sad thing is when stadiums of adults believe it. On page 105, you discuss public bads. What are public bads?
So a public bad are things that are undesirable that fall on a large number of people. And so to understand this, you have to start with public goods. And a public good, the way economists talk about it, is first of all, good is something where more is preferred to less, all else constant. So we prefer more of it to less. And a public good is one where it doesn't just fall on one person, but it has spillover effects onto others, and you can't exclude them from those benefits. And so the way that foreign military interventions are often justified in the existence of the state itself is through the provision of public goods. So the argument goes, well, there's certain things that private people left up to their own devices simply can't do because others will free ride off them. So if you and I get together and provide security, and then we keep expanding our group, other people will free ride off us and take advantage of us. And so the whole thing will break down. So the argument is you need government to come in and provide it. And then now the argument is globally that you need government to provide global public goods, the protection of private property, freedom, liberty, monetary system, all these things. Public bads are the flip side of that. They are bads that are produced by government action that are not excludable, so they spill over to other people. Discussions of empire and foreign policy in general tend to be biased towards focusing on the goods, the potential public goods, I should say, the good stuff government can do. And this goes back to what you and I were saying. Advocates of interventionism always emphasize the good stuff that's going to come from the intervention. But what about all the bad stuff that can happen? And so throughout the book, at the end of each chapter, I end with like a list of the potential public bads that can come about from intervention, because I want readers to be able to kind of sum up and say, oh, look at all these things that can happen. That can range from the death and maiming of innocent people, corruption, the erosion of domestic liberties and freedoms, pressures on the public purse, a whole host of things. Too many to list in this conversation, but they're in the book. And what I'm hoping that readers will take away is a more balanced approach to the analysis of imperialism and empire, so that when people promise them all these goodies, they can say, well, wait a second, what about the potential bad things that might happen? We have to weigh these things. And then it comes down on where you place your weight. Like, how confident are you that this huge government apparatus can deliver on the goods while minimizing the bads? And that requires a careful consideration, but I'm hoping to empower people with the analytical framework for thinking through those things.
Yeah, there is a free rider problem that exists in the world, and the biggest free riders are members of the government who get money whether or not they provide a good or service. So it's a classic example of a problem exists, therefore we should have a thing called a solution, which not only has no costs, but this previous criticism no longer applies to this. It applies many times over.
Correct.
So
yeah.
I don't believe the public goods nonsense, rather. What is polycentric defense?
So start with the contrast to a polycentric system, a monocentric system. A monocentric, mono meaning one, is a top-down centralized a decision-making unit. So when we talk about the way we typically think about the world now is nation states, and defense is provided by states, a nation state. A nation state is a monocentric system. So there's one unit, the federal government or the national government, that provides defense for everyone living under it. So it's a very top-down type system. A polycentric system is one where there are numerous decision-making units. So it's not just a single decision-making unit. And at the end of the book, in the conclusion, I say, like, look, where does this analysis lead us? Well, I'm very skeptical of empire and the ability of it to deliver what its proponents claim it's going to do. So where do we go from there? Well, any movement away from that, like retrenchment or what some people call restrained foreign policy, all else constant, if you gave me that option, I would take moving in that direction. But I'm not confident that that can sustain. And I'm not confident it can sustain because the very nature of the empire apparatus is to continually expand, to push, to expand what it does. So even if you restrained it for a moment in time, I highly doubt it would remain restrained. And so then I'm trying to think through and get the reader to think about alternatives. And one of those is a polycentric system. So instead of having a single government providing us defense, let's have dispersed defense at all different levels of society. And this doesn't just mean running around with guns shooting each other. We already engage in polycentric defense. We lock our doors. We have community watch groups. We have various forms of social organization that provide people with security from a variety of threats. And notice, going back to the point you just raised about public goods and the myth of public goods, even a citizenry needs to protect itself against abuses by state power against them. And that requires having internal security among the citizenry to push back against the state when it oversteps its bounds. And if it can't, if the citizenry can't do that, then the game's over because the government has all the power over you. And so polycentric defense already exists. We just take it for granted because we take for granted all the different ways that creative private individuals figure out ways to both navigate conflict without resorting to violence. But then when violence occurs, private citizens figure out ways to deal with that too. And so thinking about how far we can push that logic is one way to naturally restrain the state, because then we're not reliant on government to provide us with security because we can do it ourselves.
It's one of the most unbelievable contradictions you'll hear with the vast majority of self-described economists who say, we know that monopolies are bad. Monopolies give us lower quality and higher prices. Also, the state should monopolize security. It's like it doesn't even occur to them that a polycentric system is possible. But when I think of things, that is, would you consider PayPal, eBay, Amazon, or computers that have passwords on them examples of polycentric defense? My entire bank account is privately secured. And when I was unfortunately hacked, it never occurred for me to ever call 911 and report to have the cops help me. What I did was I went to the credit union directly and they privately assisted me. They had their own arbiters. Underwriters Laboratory is another one, a stamp of approval, or with baseball cards, there's all these certification agencies, stamp of approval. They give you their ratings so you can be sure that your property and titles are secure there. I see once Edward Stringham pointed this out to me. Once I saw it everywhere. What are some of the benefits I can reap from polycentric defense that I wouldn't get from monocentric defense?
Yeah, so to answer your question, you are certainly correct that polycentric security or defense against threats is all around us, because threats are all around us. Threats are an omnipresent part of human life. That's nothing to do with nation states, any of that. It's around us. We have to deal with them, and we figure out creative ways to deal with them. The thing is, they work so well, we take them for granted. We don't think about them. It's like that. This is your point, right? Once you realize that, it's like, well, this is pretty amazing. It's everywhere, but you got to sit down and think about it because it works so well. So then the question becomes, well, what does that mean in terms of how far we can push this logic, and how does it operate? What are the benefits? Well, one of the benefits is exactly what you highlighted indirectly in your comments, which it allows us to leverage local knowledge. It allows us to say what Keith Knight needs for security is different than what Chris Coyne needs. And polycentrism allows for that kind of experimentation, diversity across the provision of security, where the state provides all of us supposedly with a single set of defense policies against external threats. But there's significant variation in what we need. What else does it offer us? So it provides, allows us to leverage local knowledge and local needs. It allows for experimentation, different people to try different things. It also disperses power. So again, let's go back to what we were talking about earlier. And certainly there's bad people in the world. The worst thing you can do with a bad person is give them a lot of political power. What does a monocentric system require? Really good people to run it. Because if a really bad person or bad people, plural, get in charge, well, you're in trouble, because now you have given them the keys to this massive apparatus. And so one of the great benefits of polycentric systems is that it fully recognizes that there's bad people in the world, but it limits the bad they can do because it disperses power. And that's one of the really overlooked benefits, and I think great benefits of the system, especially when we start realizing the corrosive effects of the national security state on domestic life.
I agree with you. I think that is a much better system for people to embrace, and it's already around us. One of the most popular solutions or responses to something like a military industrial complex was given by General Smedley Butler. I want to say he was in the First World War or the Spanish-American War. I will have to double check that. But on page 43, he says, well, it's a racket, all right. A few profit and many pay, but there is a way to stop it. You can't end it by disarmament conferences. You can't eliminate it by peace parlays at Geneva. Well-meaning but impractical groups can't wipe it out by resolutions. It can be smashed effectively only by taking the profit out of war. What do you think about that solution?
Well, I think Butler was in the Philippine-American War and World War I, if I remember correctly, but I could be wrong about that too. But in any case, I'm not so sure. Because I'm not sure how you take the profit out of war. I'm not sure what that means, because on the one hand, it might mean relationships between government and private firms. But that's one form of profit. But there's other benefits to war. It's not just the provision of the goods and services and the arms of war. So there is that. But war benefits people both in politics and outside of politics in a variety of ways. And so I do think, and I have to go back and look at the broader context that Butler's speaking there from that passage you read. I do think changing the apparatus itself and thinking about alternatives is the only way to stop large-scale war. So from the standpoint I'm understanding the passage correctly, I think Butler might be off there. I don't know if you agree or disagree with that or have a thought.
So one of the mistakes is assuming that profit is a thing that uniquely applies to the bourgeoisie capitalists. He's not accounting for the fact that soldiers greatly profit from a lot of these things, both in an increase in social status, getting millions of views on social media when they come home and surprise a family member, and they get a lot of money when they come back, and you have a lot of people thanking them for their service. A lot of men are attracted to this because a lot of women find it very admirable. So they can the idea of taking profit out of it is to take human beings out of it, because when humans act, they try to decrease costs and increase both monetary and psychic profit. So it is the ultimate example of a fool's errand. So I think he's just saying that if I had to steelman it a little further, we can't allow greedy, careless mindsets to occupy these vitally important structures of society. But even that too, I mean, that there's just going to be greed everywhere. So we can recognize all those constants: people seeking profit, people are greedy, people are self-interested, there's information asymmetry. So we now have now the dichotomy is not profit or nonprofit, because there's no such thing as nonprofit. Even socialist cooperatives, everyone in the cooperative profits and they seek to decrease costs. Now, what you have heroically done in search of monsters to destroy the folly of American empire and paths to peace, so the dichotomy is not profit versus nonprofit. The dichotomy is monocentric defense, which is coercively funded, and polycentric defense, which is voluntarily funding competing organizations. And I think that's where he went wrong. He took something that applies to everyone and uniquely pinned it on the bourgeoisie. Two more questions for you. I'm a conservative. I value things like civilization, family, and tradition. Why should I be anti-war?
You should be anti-war because war corrodes those very things. It corrodes those very things in a variety of ways. I mean, one way to think about it in terms of you value family and traditional values. Well, think about, you know, let's go back to the sports displays. What's one of the main sports displays, which you touched upon a moment ago? Reuniting family members. So we'll have, you know, it tugs at the heartstrings. You have a father or a mother who hasn't seen their newborn since they were a newborn, or sometimes hasn't seen them at all, or they haven't seen their young child. Well, we celebrate that, but there's an easy way to overcome that, which is don't send them to war in the first place. So you can easily make the argument that even in the best case, when the soldier comes home, they're not killed. You still have taken them away from their family during the most formative years of children's lives. Then, of course, if they're killed or damaged in some way, which prevents them from being a effective parent, you've damaged families. And of course, we shouldn't forget spouses either, who have to live without their spouse who's away and oftentimes killed. So you can make the argument these things erode families. Then, of course, you also have things like post-traumatic stress disorder and all the other things, the kind of overlooked costs of sending people to war, the long and variable costs, health issues. All of these things erode the ability of people to be effective members of their communities, effective members of society, and their families. And to the extent those traditional values matter, you should be concerned about that. And then, of course, to the extent that other values, it depends what values we include, but if we have traditional values like, you know, respect for individual rights, respect for human liberty, limited government, war is at odds with all of these things. That is what the historical record shows, that war undermines those most cherished values. And so to the extent you are concerned with conserving those values, the military and imperial instrument should be wielded with great caution.
Now, say I'm a progressive and the things that motivate me would be a sense of justice, fairness, and equality among people. Why should I be anti-war?
So if you're a progressive along the lines that you laid out, you also should be anti-war. Well, why? Well, on the one hand, as we've been discussing throughout our time together, war tends to line the pockets of the politically well-connected. And those are typically not the marginalized people who are the typical people that people hold up. Oh, you know, the social justice advocates for the marginalized, they typically are pushed by the wayside during war, if not outright harmed. They're the ones that will tend to get pulled into the messy parts of war, sending them abroad. For those who are abroad, who are being intervened upon, typically the most vulnerable and marginalized incur the largest costs of intervention because they are the least able to protect themselves and circumvent the nefarious effects of foreign intervention. And so what else happens? As you get increases in corporate welfare and corporate privilege domestically because of the military-industrial congressional complex, that strengthens the very things that progressives tend to dislike about political capitalism. And so if you ask progressives, well, what concerns you about capitalism? There's several things they might raise, but one of them is political, what you and I would call political capitalism or crony capitalism. Warfare is peak political capitalism and is peak state capitalism. There's no better way to undermine the dynamism of markets than through warfare. And so to the extent that people are concerned with those things, they should be concerned with that. And of course, as we've been discussing, war undermines and erodes our most fundamental values, including values of justice. And so to the extent you are concerned with issues of justice and equality and human dignity, its fundamental core, warfare is a surefire way to undermine those things. And so it should be avoided at not necessarily all costs, because there will be violence in the world, but at a significant cost. And certainly at a cost that people tend to neglect, because we always set it up as, well, it's costless. This is your Santa Claus point. There's no cost. Well, then let's go to war. Wars seem great when there's no cost, but the costs are significant. And once you start thinking about them, you realize that the bar has to be extremely high to engage in intervention in the first place.
The book is In Search of Monsters to Destroy: The Folly of American Empire and the Paths to Peace. My guest today is Christopher J. Coyne. Links to the book will be in the description below. Dr. Coyne, thank you for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.